This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. From the time he was very young, Paul Watson had one dream: to play soccer, or football, as the rest of the world calls it.
My first passion was that I would play for England. You know, that was the dream. Despite not having any talent, really, no discernible sort of natural talent, you know, as the years went on, it got less and less likely. It was probably impossible by the age of 10, but it was absolutely impossible by the age of 18.
Paul wasn't good enough to play for England, so he became a football journalist who kept his dream alive by playing for a semi-pro team. But he says that wasn't enough.
I sort of found myself drifting, and at the age of 25, you know, still had this vague hope that one day I would make it in these kind of fairy tale way that people do. And that's basically where this idea was born from, this kind of desire to beat the odds and not to give up on my dream of playing international football.
Reporter James Parkinson has the story.
In 2008, Paul Watson and his flatmate Matthew Conrad found themselves reflecting on their footballing dreams, wondering what life could have been like if they had made it in the professional game.
We would sit around in the evenings and kind of watch Brazilian second division football and sort of lament our lack of talent. And one day, like a lot of fans probably around the world, we came up with the thing of saying, well, what team could we have played for if we'd been born there? You know, if we'd had a bit of luck and we'd been born in San Marino, would we be playing for them now? You know, we trawled through the FIFA rankings, got to the very, very bottom. At the time, it was Montserrat and Bhutan and those kind of teams. And that was when we found the non-FIFA rankings, you know, places that aren't recognised by FIFA. At the bottom of that was this island, Pompeii.
Pompeii, that's spelled P-O-H-N-P-E-I. It's an island in Micronesia, population just over 36,000.
And they were listed as the world's worst team. You know, Wikipedia told us they never won a game. So what we did was we sent them an email to the address that we could find for them. And that was it. That was supposed to be the end of it. But it was only actually when their head of their FA got back to us and said, you know, I'd love to help you, but I've just moved to London, that we thought, well, okay, this is kind of strange. It's probably a prank, but we'll meet up with him.
That man was Charles Musana, a Ugandan who'd spent 15 years on the island of Pompeii playing and coaching football.
And he said to us, you can't go there and play. It's harder to get Micronesian nationality than it is to get a British one. You know, you have to renounce your citizenship of your country. You have to marry a local. Even then, it's hard to get a passport. But he said, you know, don't you come over and coach? The team's basically disbanded. So come over and coach the team. And I think he thought we'd laugh about that and go home. But instead, we said yes.
At this point, Paul and Matt had no idea what they were getting themselves into. Neither of them had ever coached football before. But that didn't faze them. And they soon got to work trying to figure out how they'd actually make this happen.
It was a good sort of 13 months till we actually were able to leave. Because, you know, we had to save up money. We had to give up jobs.
Was there any point where you're like, what are we doing? This is ridiculous. Because you had quite a lot of time to think about it.
For me, one of the drivers was that through journalism, I'd found myself in a job I didn't particularly like. I wasn't exactly living the best football life that I could be. I think people knew that I was kind of a bit bored of my current job and that I felt a little bit like I couldn't work out what to do with life. They hadn't exactly expected to hear that I was planning to go to a Micronesian island for an indefinite period of time, but I think people were almost a bit relieved that I'd found something to show a passion in. More strangely, perhaps, was that my sort of long-term girlfriend and now wife, amazingly, Lizzie, basically said, you should do this. You know, it's something you want to do, and if you don't do this now, you're never going to get a chance to. I still can't properly explain it, but it was almost like this was the thing that my whole life had been setting up to do in a way. Crazy as it might seem, the thing I was most worried about that gave me sleepless nights was that someone would get there first. I had this nightmare that we would turn up and there'd be some sort of like some jobbing English manager, like, you know, like John Ward or someone out there. I'd think, oh, you know, we'd obviously be completely out of our depth and we'd just have to go home, tail between our legs.
While Paul and Matt prepared to move halfway around the world, they spent time researching this place they were planning to go to. And as they learned more about Pompeii and its people, they realised coaching a football team in this part of the world was going to be a significant challenge.
We knew as much as someone can know when they've got a computer with internet access. We knew about the high obesity rate, high diabetes rate. We knew that they'd played football, that they'd lost 16-1 to Guam a few years previously, and that had seemed to basically knock the enthusiasm out of people in the region. And all these things at the time, they didn't mean anything. It was only later on, it was one of those things where in retrospect, all these little nuggets come together and you think, wow, that's why things are so difficult in terms of football there.
After 13 months of research, Paul and Matt finally booked their flights to Pompeii. They were only planning to stay for 3 weeks to assess the situation.
It was almost like a sort of extended job interview, except it wasn't really clear who was going to give us the job. So we thought we'll do this trip and we'll see, you know, is this something we can imagine working? And then we have the option to come home, albeit without a job anymore and having made a lot of sort of quite serious, you know, I got rid of my flat and I told everyone I know I was moving to Micronesia.
Charles Musana, the man who proposed the idea of coaching the team in the first place, would come along to make introductions.
So he was getting messages from the island saying, you know, people are excited to hear there are foreign coaches coming over. You know, they're really all playing again. It's all getting going. I don't know how true that was now, looking back at it.
In July of 2009, Paul and Matt boarded their first flight to Pompeii.
Pompeii's sort of in the middle of nowhere is basically the best way to describe it. It's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, between Manila and sort of Australia, I guess. Your flight route from London is London, Dubai, Dubai, Manila, Manila, Guam, Guam, Pompeii. So you're a long way into the ocean.
After 24 hours in the air, Paul and Matt arrived in Pompeii.
It's a US protectorate, so it has a bit of a US feel to it, uses the dollar. But in many ways, it's a tropical paradise. You know, it's this incredible, shocking greenery and beautiful blue ocean. It's absolutely stunning. It's just such a friendly island. Everyone nods to everyone. It's incredibly laid back. You drive at about 10 miles an hour and you swerve around all the potholes. So for me, it was like, it was an amazing place, beautiful place. But also, you know, a place that obviously has had its problems. And I think it's quite well demonstrated as you go around Pompeii, it's stunning beauty to your left and your right. And then there's kind of litter everywhere a lot of the time.
Paul and Matt began to make connections, meet the locals, and get a sense of just how things would work on the ground.
We met the head of the Olympic Committee in Micronesia, who's called Jim Tobin, a really amazing American man who's administrated sport there for years. And he really got behind us, which was a big thing. The Olympic Committee in a place that small is a big deal. So he was behind us. And we were going down to the field every day and just seeing, you know, what level of interest there was. And it would range. You know, some days we had a 5-on-5 kick around on this sort of flooded field. Other days it would get up to sort of 20 people kicking around. Some days we'd arrange everyone to turn up at 6, they'd get there at 8. You know, it was a mess, but there was interest and there were kids coming out and kicking a football who'd never done it before. There were some who were actually clearly really good.
As for the facilities, they certainly weren't ideal. They would use the football pitch at Pacific Island Community School, which, despite its picturesque surroundings, really suffered due to the weather.
The field was effectively water most of the time. Kind of like a marsh, and there were toads. It was a toad habitat, so there were toads everywhere.
When their 3 weeks on the island were up, Paul and Matt returned home to plan their next move. For Matt, that decision was taken out of his hands. He'd gotten into film school, something he'd always wanted to do. But Paul decided to return to Pompeii and take the coaching job.
Right, and so the Federation has agreed to pay you and kind of set you up and all that as well?
No, there was no pay. That was the thing. In a way, this was the hardest thing. There was no salary. There was no real official job title. I mean, the Olympic Committee did eventually help us with hotels and with everything on the island. But no, this was part of the deal. In a weird way, I felt more comfortable that way, because if I'd taken on a professional role and commanded a salary, it wouldn't have felt particularly ethical, because I would have felt I was painting myself as something I wasn't. You know, I wasn't a professional coach. I was getting more out of this than they were in many ways. So it felt like a deal that made sense.
With Matt staying behind, Paul thought he'd have to take on this challenge alone. But when he returned to Pompeii, he met a young man named Dilshan Senarathgoda.
He'd been coaching this group of young kids. And so I met up with him and he was absolutely over the moon that I was there. He was delighted. So we strategized, you know, went to a bar, got drunk and strategized, and we drew up the idea of the Pompeii Premier League. People were interested. So what we did was we formed a league. We marked the pitch out properly. We basically set times for games. We went around the island and we recruited teams and we set up a tournament. And then when the tournament was played, we used that as a chance to coach, you know, teach local people to be the referees and the linesmen and all these kind of things. So really that league turned it all around. Not immediately, you know, it took time, but it just caused this growth of the sport. And so initially I wasn't coaching at all, really. I was more administrating this league with Dilshan. And it was only after a few months of that league where we set up sort of training for the most gifted of the players for them to become this kind of de facto national team.
By this stage, it was 2010 and Matt had come back to Pohnpei to help out. And he and Paul set about arranging some friendly matches in nearby Guam, who are recognised by FIFA and have received significant funding for their own football program.
So we contacted them and they were open to having us on tour there as long as we could find a way to get ourselves over. The players got behind this idea that we were going to play off the island, and it was incredibly motivating for them. But it also meant we had to fight this belief that they would be thrashed, because all they'd ever known is teams going away and being thrashed. I was trying to tell them to believe in themselves and to really get them pumped up and think, you know, we can do this. On the other hand, half of me was thinking, well, maybe we will lose 30-0. And if we did, we'd just come back and there'd be a sense of, well, what was the point in that? You know, we may as well stop again.
The guys lined up matches against three different club teams, plus one fixture with a Guam under-18 side.
And we lost our first game 3-2 to a Guam second division team. And the players were devastated. It was like the end of the world to them. But I got to admit, I was ever so slightly relieved. You know, I thought, we can actually win one on this tour now. And it was actually the second game that we played against, again, a Guam second division team. They turned up for a friendly. Our players, it was kind of the game of their lives. So I felt quite sorry for the Guam team. They didn't really realise what they were signing up for. And I remember we were 6-1 up with 4 minutes left. And I just stood on the sideline, and instead of being happy, I was just there with clenched fists, just going, clear it, clear it, clear it. Just thinking, if we actually threw this away, we may as well just disband football in Micronesia for good, because, you know, no one will ever believe in themselves again. But yeah, we did. We won that game. And there was a little community of Pompeians in Guam who had come out to support us. And there was kind of like this small pitch invasion and the flag being sort of pinned on the posts, and it was just this lovely moment of a very tiny triumph, but one that meant a lot more to us.
Pohnpei went on to lose the third match 2-1 before being defeated 3-0 by the Guam youth team. But Paul says they'd already achieved what they set out to do.
For us, what it felt like was a real vindication of the fact that, you know, Pohnpeians really could achieve something through football. And I think the players went home inspired by what they saw in Guam, because it was absolutely beyond their dreams, but equally feeling like they'd competed on a level in some way, you know, maybe 20, 30 years short of getting to where Guam are as a national team, but still, you know, worthy of being put on a map with them. And I think that meant a lot, really.
After all that, what did you learn through that process? And, you know, how did it change you?
I came on the start of this journey because I couldn't quite find a place in football. And I think I'd felt a disconnection with the more corporate game, the commercialization of it. And I think what I got was I got back to something a lot purer, you know, through probably the least pure route there is, this ego trip of wanting to be an international player and this kind of all the trappings that entails and all this rubbish that I'd had in my brain. Strip that all away. And actually what I really enjoyed was just seeing people express themselves through football and the way that they grew and the way that they opened out. There are different worlds of football, you just got to find yours, and I think I eventually found mine.
That story came from reporter James Parkinson. He's the host of the podcast By Association. These days, Paul Watson works for CONIFA, helping to grow football in the many nations and territories not recognized by FIFA. In 2012, he published a book about his experience in Micronesia. It's called Up Pohnpei. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Starting college can be overwhelming.
Everyone from almost every background has that fear that they got in here by accident. That's scary.
NPR's Life Kit is here to help make your freshman year a little easier. Listen to NPR Life Kit's new guide on college, or subscribe to Life Kit All Guides for all the episodes all in one place.
I'm Jason Gay, and it's time for three stories you should know. On Thursday night, the NFL returned. All right, let's be honest. The NFL never really goes away. But the 2019 regular season began, and this week we're going to begin by talking about one team that people are getting a little too excited about. I'm joined by the Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed via Skype and by New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
An honor as always, sir.
All right, gang, you know that I'm a upbeat person who likes positivity in sports. I just want to cool the engine on a bit of hype that's truly getting out of hand. And I mean the 2019 Super Bowl champion Cleveland Browns. I mean, come on. It is getting crazy. Do you realize Las Vegas right now is awash? Awash! In big money on the Cleveland Browns. Many millions have been ventured on Cleveland's playoff dreams and more. You know, I believe Will, who's an otherwise reasonable guy, has sunk his children's entire college fund into a Cleveland Browns Super Bowl bet. Folks, I get the enthusiasm. I get that they're a good story. They have fun players like Baker Mayfield and Odell Beckham Jr. and Cleveland, one of the great sports towns on planet Earth. But this team has not made the playoffs in 17 seasons. Let's get there first and hold off on Super Bowl reservations in South Florida for now. What do you guys think? Will?
Well, first off, you're making me feel very nervous about my 2019 Cleveland Browns facial tattoo that I got yesterday. I guess in retrospect, even if they had one, that's still probably a bad idea for a tattoo. I have to say, I'm not quite with you on this. This is excitement, right? Like, to me, once the Cubs won the World Series, and by the way, this is where this Cardinal fan reminds you that we spent our entire lives saying, if the Cubs win the World Series, the world's going to end. And then it ended like a week later, by the way, just to remind everyone. But nevertheless, the Browns story is probably the next big thing, right? The Browns winning the Super Bowl is probably the NFL's equivalent of the Cubs winning the World Series. Cardinal fans might not have liked it when the Cubs won the World Series, but I guarantee you baseball did. They loved it. That's a huge story. Never minding the fact that the Browns have all of these great personalities. Baker Mayfield is like, it's fun to have like a good trolling quarterback, and Odell Beckham drives everybody insane. And even Nick Chubb, like they even have a likable, if you have no one else to root for Nick Chubb. Nick Chubb is really likable. This Browns team has all of the things you want from a football team, individual personalities, longstanding pain, and the possibility that the pain could only get worse. This is exactly the type of story you want to sign on for. So whether they win the Super Bowl or they don't win the Super Bowl, this seems to me the kind of the entry point for the NFL this year.
Okay, this is unexpected, but I'm going to say that, you know, my bar for appreciating NFL teams is really low. They're named after original coach and owner. They're not an offensive indigenous mascot. Their owner is not horrific in their outward racism. So let's just pause for a minute. I'm also quite appreciative of teams that people might not think would make it. Cue my amplification of the 2019 NBA champions, the Toronto Raptors. Nobody thought they could win, and people cashed in on that. So I'm kind of a supporter of the underdog. Will, I will add $10 to your facial tattoo fee. Part of sports is things happening that we don't expect. So I like low expectations from teams like Cleveland. And, you know, it's not the most phenomenal city in the United States, but my bar is sort of like, are they really as offensive as everybody else? And if not, I might root for them at some point.
I appreciate you chipping in for that, because currently it only says Clev Brow. I didn't get the second half of it finished. So thank you for helping me out with that.
All right, Shireen, it's your turn, and it's a low bar to clear.
Tennis. Who would have thought it would bring us so much joy? Bianca Andreescu, who's actually from my city of Mississauga, the 19-year-old tennis phenom from Canada. Yes, I said Canada. We all know that Canadians are very nice people, our abouts, our sorries, our donuts. I think it's really important to remember that sport is still very intense. And when you see friendship and sisterhood emerge on the court, actually at the Canadian Open, the Rogers Cup, of Bianca Andreescu going up to Serena. Serena had to withdraw, and her sort of saying, you know, I love you, you're an effing legend, is so important because it sets a stage for something. And what it set a stage for was later when Coco Gauff, the 15-year-old phenom, was beaten up by Naomi Osaka. We saw that again. We saw a repetition of that type of sisterhood, the camaraderie that we don't often get enough of in sports. Like, we love it. We don't get enough of it. And I will thank Canada for this. I think Canada is the catalyst for everything wonderful. So thank you, tennis. I've never really paid attention till now, but thank you.
Well, what do you think? Do you like seeing tennis players want to, like, strangle each other across the net, like old school Ilya Stasi style? Or do you like this? Do you like the hug it out 2019 tennis?
I don't know why we can't have both. To me, the great quote that Coco had after her, the thing that Steve Kerr quoted, for me, the definition of an athlete is someone who on the court treats you like your worst enemy, but off the court can be your best friend. To me, that's what I kind of love of this. As Kerr noted, like he said, this is the essence of competition, and she had it figured out at 15, and he was 35 before it finally hit him. But I think what's great is you're having these very charismatic, very outgoing, and just very like exciting to watch players kind of showing this on the grand stage. And it's not fake. You know, to me, so much of sportsmanship has always been tied in some sort of performative aspect. And the idea you shake hands afterwards, but then you grumble later and you show class. This is what actual sportsmanship is. And for me, that's very exciting to see.
And there's something about tennis, the fact that it is a solo sport, an individual sport. It can be a lonely lifestyle. I am just struck by the maturity. You look at somebody like Coco Gauff. When I was 15 years old, all I want to do is, like, drink beer in the woods. Like, the idea that, like, somehow I could just be this ambassador for sportsmanship, not to mention a massive talent who I would bet you anything, including a face tattoo on Will's forehead, is going to win a whole bunch of majors. I'm just gobsmacked by how just they have it all together at such an early age. Because, you know, tennis has a bad tradition of, you know, early burnout, some real, like, bad behavior. This is not the case now.
And what I really appreciated too is Naomi Osaka is in her early 20s. And for her to mentor Coco Gauff like that and then pay heed to Coco's parents, like, I was crying. I was like sobbing into my hijab with emotion because I really was moved by that respect, that deference. And, you know, Naomi Osaka being so young as well, I want more of that. Like, I like my anger and my hostility in my hockey, but tennis, I will take this. And, and particularly when it amplifies women of color this way, where tennis has been a traditionally white sport. So it's also refreshing on many levels to see that, like, we can be like 15-year-old Coco Gauff. We don't all have to just think about drinking in the woods, even though that's okay.
By the way, when I was 21, I was also thinking about drinking beer in the woods. Will, we're going to go to you and your tattoo artist. What do you got for us?
In the spirit of Coco and competition, I am going to waste your topics, you two. You guys are going down. I know we've been talking about Andrew Luck a lot over the last couple of weeks, and with good reason. I still have not quite shaken the fan reaction to Andrew Luck coming off the field. The fact is, Colts fans booed Andrew Luck. When you unpack that for a moment, realize that like the Indianapolis Colts have been terrible for 9 years in every other aspect other than Andrew Luck. He ran away because he didn't want to hurt himself in this game anymore. And it felt like a Rubicon cross to me to see the way that Luck was treated by his hometown fans. There's a sense of entitlement to it. I think fantasy sports has had a lot to this. We've always understood that players are different and it's not a one-on-one back and forth relationship. But now I think that's curdled into something. You also saw this with Djokovic when he was booed when he retired from the U.S. Open. There's something now about not just these athletes are separate than us, but they owe us, and if they don't give us what I want, they are not people. They are just no longer providing me entertainment. And as someone that's generally a big fan of fans, as someone that's a fan myself, it felt like something particularly ugly happening, and I still haven't quite shaken it.
Yeah, I like what Will said about entitlement. The fan reaction was really disappointing for me because, like, I mean, I think of Indiana as generally, like, you know, with their football teams, a pretty nice place. It was my favorite episode of Parks and Rec was the one that he was on it. And I don't even know if it's the majority of fans. I hope not. And I don't think it was. But I think we need to start looking at sports sometimes a little more profoundly. And those fans, like, you got such a big will and a big mouth. You go take a spot.
I like this. I like this very much, the idea of bringing a fan down to quarterback the Indianapolis Colts. I think this is fantastic.
Well, the WNBA does it. When men start saying, oh, I can take this person out. I played, you know, recreational pickup in college. Yeah, we've seen that happen. I think this should happen on the football field.
I love it. Because I'm just a virtuoso radio host now, I'm going to take what Will talked about and Shireen talked about and combine them, because there is a person in sports who is harnessing this crazy fan energy that's out there, and his name is Daniil Medvedev. He is a Russian tennis player. He is 23 years old, and he has done something I frankly have not seen in sports, which is to take fan anger and channel it into something that looks like a combination of professional tennis and the WWE. I don't know if you've caught any of his matches. I mean, this is a guy who is taking all this anger and repurposing it and raising his profile and his game. It's sublime to watch, and I applaud him for it. He's a new model for the 21st century athlete.
I still don't think he should have hit his opponent with that chair.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed, also the co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Shireen was available via Skype and via conch shell. New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach, thanks to both of you. And please don't put all your money on the Browns.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
My friends, I'm not in the business of telling people what to talk about. I say speak, and speak freely. Except when it comes to the topic of fantasy football. Then I don't want to hear about it. And I know I'm not alone. Now, let me be clear. I have no problem with what Americans do in the privacy of their own homes. And if that includes the infernal, soul-sucking habit of playing fantasy football, i.e. selecting a scattershot team of NFL players to whom you'll attach your human emotions for the next 5 months, well then, good for you. Fantasy football is undoubtedly huge today. It's huge! It's America's second most popular hobby, right after screaming at strangers on the internet. But have you ever listened to somebody talk about his or her fantasy football team? It's like listening to someone talk about their cat, but worse. Fantasy football matters greatly to the person playing the fantasy football, but not much to anyone else. Now, I don't care that your running back is underperforming. I don't even care that your quarterback was a steal. And I definitely don't care that you have great optimism in yielding points from the Houston Texans defense. Again, this is nothing personal. I'd just rather hear you talk about your cat. Honestly, I'd rather argue about politics with random people on an airplane than listen to somebody talk about their fantasy football team. I would rather hear about a kayak vacation that you took 5 years ago. I wouldn't even mind hearing about a kayak vacation you took 20 years ago. You know that one where you lost your hat? What I'm trying to say is fantasy football talk is dull. Duller than a wet cardboard box. It's a fictitious event with low stakes that apply only to the participants. It's basically hermit crab racing, but with humans. The good news is that you have some options. If you live with someone who plays fantasy football, I don't want you to consider divorce or separation or buying a plane ticket to the south of France and never coming back. I just need you to go to the hardware store and buy as much scrap lumber as you can find. Now take that lumber and a bunch of nails and pound away in the yard for a few hours until you have constructed a handsome single-room structure with room for a hot plate and a lawn chair. We're going to call this the Fantasy Shed. And the Fantasy Shed is there for moments where family and friends begin to talk about their fantasy football team. All you have to do is raise your arm in the air and bellow, "To the Shed!" And off they will go to the Fantasy Shed, where they can sit in this remote, one-person, hopefully soundproof cabin and talk to themselves for as long as they want about their wonderful fantasy team. They can talk about potential trades and their playoff moves and offer very strong opinions about the Tampa Bay kicking situation. You win, they win, we all win. It's a perfect solution. Again, I'm not denying that fantasy football is a modern phenomenon and can be loads of fun. I just think it belongs outside in a small wooden shed. Haley Sutter knows the exact day she became a runner. It was September 14th, 2008. 2001.
I didn't run a step that day. I didn't run a step for 8 months thereafter, but that is when I identify myself as becoming a runner.
Haley's story is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
What do all of these people have in common? Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders.
They're all running for president.
And they've all sat down with us on the NPR Politics podcast.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
We are going out on the trail with as many of the Democratic presidential candidates as we can and are bringing you in-depth interviews with them.
Come along by subscribing to the NPR Politics podcast.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, Curtis Granderson was ready to quit baseball when he got called up to the bigs. 16 years later, he's still there. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
The NFL season, it's underway. The Green Bay Packers and the Chicago Bears kicked off the season on Thursday. Final score, 10-3 Packers. Scintillating. How to start the 2019 campaign with a bang, huh?
Thursday night football just stinks. The excuse during the season is that, you know, you play on Sunday, then you have to play again on Thursday. This was the first game of the year, and it was a terrible game.
Yeah.
Thursday night football is a bad idea.
Well, it was on brand for Thursday night football,
it,
I guess.
It was definitely on brand, yes.
Isn't this game supposed to feature, like, the defending Super Bowl champ? What's the deal?
Well, as we are all going to be informed relentlessly over the next 6 months or so, this is the 100th anniversary of the National Football League. It's actually the 99th anniversary, but it's the 100th season. Go figure that. And they needed, you know, two foundational franchises, I guess, and there aren't two more foundational franchises than the Bears and the Packers.
Yeah, I mean, Packers and Bears, I get it. You know, it's a great traditional rivalry, but didn't it peak in, like, 1949?
Well, no, I think it probably was supposed to peak this year because the Bears are considered a Super Bowl contender, as are the Packers. But it certainly didn't peak on Thursday night.
Meanwhile, Charlie, the Dallas Cowboys have signed star running back Ezekiel Elliott to a 6-year, $90 million contract on Wednesday, which I believe has like a $50 million guarantee. Elliott has held out the entire preseason. Is this going to change the way that marquee players negotiate contracts in the future?
Well, I think you pretty much have to be an Ezekiel Elliott to pull this one off. He says that he got his $90 million extension because, quote, I believe I'm the best. He may well be. And he had them over a barrel and they knew it. He makes Dak Prescott so much better when he's in the lineup that the Cowboys really had no choice. You know, I guess Jerry Jones had to sell off a natural gas well or something for it.
Now, getting him back in Dallas, does this change at all your forecast of the balance of power in the NFC?
Well, it certainly changes the forecast of the balance of power in the NFC East. The Cowboys became a serious, serious threat.
LeBron James, meanwhile, has put considerable weight behind proposed California legislation that would prohibit California schools from rescinding scholarships and eligibility from athletes who make money off their own celebrity. This is the whole name and likeness thing, Charlie. Will LeBron's assist help pass this fair pay-to-play bill?
LeBron has enough clout to change this particular dynamic. The NCAA's position on outside income is even more indefensible than their position on paying the athletes a straight stipend or salary. There is absolutely no reason why the NCAA should be able to use someone's face and likeness to make money for itself without cutting them in on the profits. I mean, it's absurd. Now, LeBron, you know, has many avenues of complaint at his disposal. I think it's possible that he will change the dynamic within the legislature on this.
How interesting it is for a guy who did not play college basketball to become sort of a heavyweight in this whole conversation.
Well, there's no question that he has ambitions after his playing career is over to be a force both inside and outside the arena. I've said for years that I think he's going to wind up being the commissioner of the NBA, and I still believe that.
Mm. You don't think it's going to be Dwight Howard?
I don't think it's going to be DeMarcus Cousins either.
Now, this might come as a shock to you, Charlie, but New Orleans Pelican Lonzo Ball has come forward and admitted that the $500 big baller brand ZO2 shoes that he and his father LeVar peddled, they weren't so great. In fact, Lonzo says multiple pairs of big baller shoes fell apart during games, and that might be one reason he struggled early in his career. Charlie, I know you're wearing some big ballers right now, but are you surprised by this?
No, not at all. I'm not surprised at anything that the paterfamilias of the Ball family would be involved in would blow up literally on, you know, under his son's own feet. I like the way Lonzo plays. I think he's going to have a good year. But my Lord, you can't have shoes exploding on you. If he lost four of them, then something's gone wrong in production.
Meanwhile, the Vuelta a España cycling race is underway in Spain, and an aerial shot from the bike race's helicopter led to a police raid. What did the helicopter unmask?
The guys were growing weed on their roofs. They had literal plantations on their roofs. That stinks. You should be able to enjoy a sporting event from a lounge chair in your marijuana plantation without having the, you know, the whirly pig come over and rat you out to the local police.
This is like being narked out by the Goodyear blimp or something.
It's exactly
like that.
What it is. It's exactly what it is. It's like it's like a really embarrassing remake of that Black Sunday movie where the sniper rides the blimp into the Super Bowl.
And finally, Charlie, I made my case earlier in the program for Cleveland Browns fans and pundits to maybe calm down a little bit about the team's prospects this year. But maybe that advice came too late for one Ohio car dealership. What do you think?
Yeah, they've produced, there's a Kia Stinger now with a Browns theme, meaning it's an incredibly garish orange with a brown stripe going down the middle of it. I'm going to wait and see until maybe mid-season before I safely ride in one of these things, because you just know that something unbelievable, something that has never happened to an automobile in the history of automotives is going to happen to this car.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
Friends, you may be aware that Taylor Swift has a new album that's available on Spotify. You know what else is available on Spotify? The Only a Game podcast. Please subscribe and do your part to help us catch up to Taylor's 42 million monthly listens. There's a video, and you can find it online, of last December's California International Marathon. In it, the clock above the finish line is counting up to 2 hours and 45 minutes. That's the qualifying standard for the Olympic marathon trials. The California International Marathon is a fast race, specifically marketed to runners who hope to qualify for the Olympic trials. And on this day, 99 women had crossed the finish line within the qualifying time when this happened.
Oh, no! Did you see what she did?
She fell
and missed it.
Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Some people spend their whole lives figuring out what they want to be. Haley Sutter figured it out when she was 12.
I became a runner. I know the specific date that I became a runner.
It was September 14th, just a few weeks after Haley started seventh grade.
I didn't run a step that day. I didn't run a step for 8 months thereafter, but that is when I identify myself as becoming a runner.
Haley was helping her volleyball team set up for the next day's match. And when the coach left the gym for a few minutes, Haley and her teammates got the idea, as seventh graders sometimes do, to ride around on the dollies meant to carry chairs.
I had a friend in the front and I was in the back, and my friend in the front of this dolly was kind of kicking to make us go faster, and I saw her doing that, and without even thinking, I was like, oh, I should do that too. So I put my foot down to give us a kick, and the dolly just severed through my ankle. So it's a very disgusting story if you really imagine the details, so please don't.
Haley had severed her Achilles tendon. The next day, she sat between her parents while the operating surgeon explained that Haley would most likely walk with a limp for the rest of her life.
She's never going to run. She's never going to play sports. And I remember sitting there, and I'm so lucky that I was a defiant 12-year-old, and I said, well, I'm going to show you.
And she did. By the time she was in high school, Haley wasn't just a runner. She had set her sights on her school's record for the mile.
And I never, you know, even came within 30 seconds of it. I always wanted to push myself and set really big, you know, perhaps unattainable, but exciting and scary goals for myself.
But the first time Haley ever ran a marathon, she didn't set a big, scary goal. She just wanted to see if she could do it. As it turned out, she didn't just finish. On a hot, humid day in Houston, she finished in 2:52.37, just 7 minutes and 37 seconds slower than the time needed to qualify for the Olympic trials.
Afterward, everyone was like, oh my gosh, if the weather would have been great, like, I wonder what time you could have ran. And, you know, kind of getting it in my ear that I was only 7 minutes off, like, in my first ever marathon, which is still a lot. 7 minutes in a marathon is a lot of time. But running that first one and having a good level of success made me think I could potentially go after this.
So I read that your first attempt, like official attempt to qualify, was at something called Grandma's, which
Grandma's
I've never
Marathon.
Heard of.
Yep. Yeah. So Grandma's Marathon is in Duluth, Minnesota. The course is just generally really favorable. It's a place where a lot of people attempt to break the OTQ.
OTQ, the Olympic Trials Qualifying Standard. It's just one of many running terms you might want to look up before having a conversation with Haley Sutter. But back to the story. All right, so take me to the morning of the race. How were you feeling?
So nervous. Usually I'm pretty calm and confident in myself, but I was thinking about all those things that I didn't do or I should have done. Like, just thinking of cross training, like, I didn't lift enough, I didn't swim, I didn't do abs, you know, I should have been stretching more and, like, rolling out my muscles. Little things, auxiliary things that are oftentimes necessary to kind of get to the next level.
I've known you for, like, 31 minutes, and I bet you had done quite a few of them.
Yeah, and I had, and I was just kind of digging myself into this, like, pit of despair and just, you know, being irrational in some ways.
So you're really nervous. You get to the starting line. Then what happens?
Stay nervous. Yeah, I found a group of girls who were also trying to run the qualifying standards, so just kind of, like, grouped up with them and, you know, essentially just waited for the gun to go off.
Haley doesn't usually run in a group. She's more comfortable setting her own pace. But at Grandma's, because she had set such a big, scary goal, she thought a pace group might help. But the group went out too fast for Haley. By mile 10, the rest of the group had pulled ahead. By mile 20, Haley realized that she wasn't going to be able to catch up.
And so you have these people who, you know, they're either keeping pace or picking it up a little bit, and I'm, like, slowly slowing down. So it's just like these, like, stars in the galaxy, like if you've seen Star Wars, and, like, the stars are, like, flying past. That's, like, exactly what it felt like.
Haley crossed the line at 2:52.56, nearly 8 minutes off her goal. But she didn't dwell on her disappointment for long.
You know, once I decided, okay, you know what, I'm not out of the game, I still have this, then CIM was pretty much the only marathon at that point that I wanted to do.
CIM, California International Marathon. It's held in early December in Northern California. Like Grandma's, it's a mostly straight, mostly flat course. Lots of runners use it to try to set qualifying times.
It's just historically a really fast, really strong field.
This time, Haley banished all those irrational thoughts.
So I was really relaxed, and I was really confident in telling people to, like, 2:45 or bust.
By mile 2, Haley felt so good that she found her mantra. She says they often come to her in the early parts of a race. She started repeating to herself over and over, you're gonna do it. You just have to get there.
Which then became kind of ironic in the last couple miles when I was telling myself this.
Haley says she had little flashes of doubt along the way. She knew that was normal, and she just kept telling herself, you're gonna do it. You just have to get there.
From 20 to 23 is when it just started to kind of progressively get a little bit harder. And then at mile 23 is when I really remember thinking, like, oh no, like, this is getting really bad.
With just 2/10 of a mile to go, Haley remembers seeing a man dressed in a Jesus costume holding a sign that said, the end is near.
And I remember, like, looking at him, and I'm so delirious at this point too, just thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, this could be my end.
The finish line was just a block past the final turn.
So I round the curve, and you can see the clock. They have the, like, big finishing banner, and they have the clock there. And the announcer said, 30 seconds to go. Let's see how many of these women can make it. So women are starting to sprint beside me, and I'm just watching the seconds tick by. And I could feel my legs getting wobbly. And if you look at the video, like, I'm trying to run as fast and straight as I can, but I'm starting to swerve. And someone on the sideline actually got these really kind of devastating but beautiful pictures of me as I'm falling. And you can see, like, I kind of turn my head up and start to scream, and then I fall right there.
Oh, no!
Haley doesn't remember much of this next part. She knows she crawled maybe 5 or 10 feet across the finish line, and she knows what was running through her mind as she did it.
Just get there. So, like, when I was crawling, I was like, just get there, just get there.
By the time Haley crawled across the finish, the clock read 2:45:07, 7 seconds over the Olympic trials qualifying standard.
They better give it to her.
Great job.
Oh, my God. Did you see that?
Volunteers picked Haley up off the ground and walked with her until she came back to her senses.
And I was asking this one lady who was, like, helping me, I was like, is it chip time or is it gun time?
The clock above the finish line displayed the time since the starting gun was fired. That's gun time. But it was a big field. Haley knew it had taken her a few seconds to cross the starting line after the gun went off. The chip in her bib would have recorded how long it actually took her to get from the start line to the finish line. And that's chip time. The volunteer didn't know which time was used for the OTQ, so Haley still didn't know if she'd qualified. So she left the course, went to brunch with her dad and her boyfriend. That's when she got a text from her roommate that said,
"Oh my gosh, Haley did it, Haley did it," and with a screenshot of my finishing time, which was 2:45:00 by chip. And so at that point, I was so excited and was like, "Oh my gosh, we did it." I remember I gave my dad and my boyfriend, we were all hugging and cheering, and I was so excited.
But Haley hadn't done it. A little later, she got a call from her coach. The qualifying standard went by gun time, not chip time.
You know, it honestly still was fine because I was really proud of myself. I had ran a huge PR. I knew that I pushed myself as far and as hard as I could. And so, you know, it didn't even think to be devastated that I didn't do it.
And then Haley got another call from a more experienced runner who knew how to petition USA Track and Field to accept chip time instead of gun time.
And so I'm sitting at brunch, like, fielding all these phone calls. My phone is dying. So at one point, I was actually in the bathroom charging my phone.
A few months later, USA Track and Field accepted Haley's appeal, qualifying her for the Olympic Trials Marathon in Atlanta on February 29th, 2020. And that video of her fallen crawl at the finish line, it's been watched over and over by thousands of people. But as you've probably guessed by now, Haley's not the kind of person to let that bother her.
You know, there are two options. There's two avenues you can take. You can find it hilarious, or you can find it devastating. My dad doesn't like to watch it. He finds it really sad. I think it's funny, but I also kind of see it as an empowering moment too, that so I didn't run across the finish line, I crawled. Throughout my life, I'll look back on that moment and take it as a metaphor that when things aren't going my way and I'm not achieving what I want to, that, you know, maybe I just need to change tactics.
At last count, 335 women have qualified for the 2020 U.S. Olympic Trials Marathon. The fastest has a time of just under 2:21. Haley Sutter is all the way down at the bottom of the list, tied for last place with 2:45. But as always, she's set a big, scary goal for herself. She wants to finish in the top 50.
That's a huge goal, and I might not get there, but as long as I don't finish dead last, I've done better than expected.
That story came from Only a Game's Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Kyrie Thompson. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Karen Given. I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.